Hi Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time. Before I begin with some hardball questions, I wanted to ask you if you're familiar with this Tamil actor called Siddharth.
No, I'm not.
Okay, I mean, when I saw your photo on the website, it was eerily, similar to the actor, and I was like, oh my God, I was a bit surprised. And then, anyways, I just wanted to share that with you. All right. So moving on, I wanted to talk about China for a bit. In the worst case scenario, is it really bad? What is the worst thing that could happen if, China becomes the most dominant military slash technological superpower? Is there a downside to it, or is it, it's or is it like, it's not the worst that could happen? Like, do you think about that?
It's a complicated question. I guess it depends on if the Chinese government, if Xi Jinping is still in power. I think since I'm from the United States and people kind of always see like America as being the most dominant country, economic, military power since World War II, a lot of people see that as a negative because there's been the US has started so many wars and done so many invasions and done so many unethical things around the world. So some people kind of think, well, China will be better. It'll be good to have another power. It'll be good to have an alternative to the United States. But I'm concerned like that if you look at the Chinese government and look at their actions within China and their kind of aggression in the South China Sea, on the Himalayas, in Central Asia, that it could be either the same in terms of it could be just as bad or worse. And the fact that it's a authoritarian dictatorship, single party dictatorship, could make it a lot worse because there'd be no mechanisms to change things from within. So, I mean, in the US, you had Vietnam War protests, you had, at least activist labor and social activist movements within the country that did have positive global impacts and domestic impacts. And you don't have space for that in China. And that's really worrying. So there's no way for people within the country, at the current state to, change their government or affect their policies. It really depends on what the Chinese Communist Party decides. And so we're kind of just hoping, if China becomes the most powerful country, we're hoping that the Chinese Communist Party will do the right thing. But there's no mechanism to force them to do the right thing, and there's no mechanism to engage with people within China due to the Great Firewall. So it's really worrying. I don't want to be one of those people that thinks like the US was great and China will be worse. I think there's been a lot of problems with US hegemony, but I think we have to be deeply concerned if it's being replaced by Chinese hegemony and the current state of the Chinese government. It could be really harmful as well, and it could be, yeah.
Right.
I'm deeply concerned.
Right. So how effective do you think, I mean, as for my understanding, I mean, US at least had, US at least made the effort to, build a lot of allies, either in the European bloc, or, some other parts of the world as well. How effective do you think, the Chinese, China is going to be, in building these allies so that they can maybe foster their agenda globally. Am I making sense with that question?
Yeah, it's interesting because China doesn't have any like official formal allies. Like the US had formal allies all around the world,
Right.
but China doesn't. But they have a lot of countries like Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Pakistan especially, that are kind of like are de facto allies in terms that they'll kind of do China's bidding at venues like the United Nations or the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, or ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So they have these kind of informal allies that kind of do their bidding, but they don't have the kind of same formalized structures like NATO or kind of the connections the US had in terms of trade agreements with NAFTA or other things like the same kind of level of formalization globally that the United States had. So it's very different. So it'll be interesting to see like how that changes. I think the first we're starting to see the signs of the first Chinese overseas military bases. I think there's one in Tajikistan. There's always concerns there might end up being one in Pakistan or Sri Lanka. There is concerns they might do something in Afghanistan. They might take over a U.S. military base in Afghanistan. So it'll be interesting to see how the security arrangements evolve over time. But it's quite, yeah, it's interesting. It's different and it's worth watching at this point. There's nothing clearly clear what direction it's going.
Do you think it's primarily because China is still kind of figuring out their development process, the development in-house? I mean, internally, as I mean, I think US when it really started expanding, it was probably economically doing that pretty well, and it also had a good military. It ha also had a good military presence as well. Do you think China is starting to ramp that up?
Yeah, I'm so just to be honest, like I cover China more from a regional perspective, so I don't have like a lot of expertise on what's happening within China necessarily, especially economic, and because it's very, very murky and it's very difficult if you don't speak Chinese and you're not based there or have the network there to really understand how decisions are being made or how the state of the economy is. So I can't speak so much on that. It is the trade in terms of like trade, like I focus on Southeast Asia, and now nearly every country in Southeast Asia has China as its top trading partner, and top foreign direct investor. So in that sense, China has, in many ways, like overtaken the U.S. and Europe in terms of its economic might, in terms of like it's how it imports products, like raw materials, and how it's made these countries dependent on trade and Chinese economic. And that's a form of like indirect influence that can lead to maybe more military or more other types of power. So I think the economic I guess standing is there. It's hard to know like how sustainable it is and how if it's how you they'll translate that into different types of power globally.
Just a few more on China, and then we'll move on. Do you have any thoughts on the US-China trade war in general?
Not so much. It was very confusing when it started, because I'd written a piece, I think back in 2000, like before Trump was elected. I was always curious, like why there was never action against China for what I call digital trade protectionism, which is like China's blocking of Google and Facebook and all these foreign social media and other platforms, including things like Slack and ones that were more like. It really ones you could really say they were more about protecting Chinese companies than they were about even censorship, and why there wasn't more action about like closing off the digital market to these foreign companies. And I was always kind of perplexed by the trade war, because it like when it was under Trump, they were focusing on like physical goods and things that didn't seem that important. So I never really kind of got understood the strategy behind it. It seemed kind of like a tit for tat thing. It's still kind of uncertain the effects it had. There, I think that what's interesting that's happening now is like you're starting to see kind of technology supply chains and garment supply chains be a little bit decoupled, because of security concerns, but also because of human rights and forced labor concerns. And we saw the passage 2 weeks ago in the US of the Uyghur Forced Labor Act that would put the burden on companies to ensure that their products that are coming from Xinjiang are not being used with or do not have forced labor in the supply chain. And that could actually, if it's enforced properly and if the data is there, that could have like an even bigger impact in turn for a lot of companies' supply chains, because a lot of it's a cra cra quite incredible how many products have some source coming from that region of China. So, yeah, the trade war itself wasn't very strategic, but I think I'm curious to see how things will evolve in terms of technology and garments, and also if there's going to be some action on digital protectionism and digital trade in the future.
Are you surprised by the amount of surveillance that's that kind of takes place in that country by how far they go in the sense that they have installations of CCTVs on the street monitoring citizens. Are you surprised by that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess I'm surprised how quickly it happened. Like, it's incredible how fast they developed these like AI-enabled surveillance technology and how they kind of integrated it into the system that can like track people like almost anywhere in the country. I think BBC had a piece a few years ago where they like let one of their journalists out of the city, and they did an experiment to see how long it would take the police to track them or find that journalist. And it took something like 15 or 16 minutes for them to find this one person in this humongous city. I forgot which city, but it is quite amazing how the technology and how capable it is and how it can be used. I did one article about the India-Tibet border and how prior to 2009 there would be something like 1 to 2,000 Tibetans who would cross every year. But the last 5 or 6 years, it's come down to like less than 20, and most of them don't even cross the border because the technology, surveillance technology along the Tibet border with India and Nepal, is so high tech. Even in this sort of highly remote region, they can track anyone coming, and they can make it so that people cannot cross anymore freely. So it is. It's. I'm amazed how effective it is. They haven't built a border wall between India, Nepal, and China, but they've created one basically using digital technology that's almost impenetrable, and that's quite astounding. And it's worrying to see if that technology starts getting exported to other countries, other
Right.
especially authoritarian countries, and if they start using it to track. And we're seeing some examples of that in some places where some of these technologies have been used to, track political opponents, or, minorities. It's really worrying if that technology starts spreading around the world more quickly.
But I mean, do you think, these kind of, I mean, China is obviously a special case, and I think everyone does consider that. Do you think like the kinds of things that China is doing will fly in other countries? I mean, will the public will there be acceptance of these technologies being used in other countries as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think there is it's interesting that like the in the countries that have like used this technology, I think there's it's been like Ecuador, Ethiopia. I know there's instances. It hasn't been they haven't been able to use it nearly as effectively as China in terms of like clamping down opposition or creating the kind of society they want to, like the wannabe authoritarian leaders. So there's an argument to be made that like the Chinese model isn't really exportable. I think we can see this with the pandemic. Like China went with this like very hard lockdown, strict authoritarian model, and that was like enabled partly by the surveillance system that allows them to track people to this like very, very minute level. And no other country in the world could ever do that, and I don't think they would for a long time. So China hasn't been able to export their COVID kind of model, even though they're kind of like promoting it. None of their allies even have been able to utilize it or learn from the Chinese experience. So they can't even share that model. Maybe they can't share their surveillance model either. Maybe I think it's kind of the same thing.
Before I'm, is there something that you've seen China doing which you I mean there are obviously a lot of things that China does very bad, but is there something that you have seen where you are like this is pretty neat or this is pretty cool?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I guess in terms of a environment and energy, because I do also do some reporting there. China has been very ahead of the curve in terms of like deploying solar technology and wind and I did a piece a couple of years ago about like water and flooding, and China has this whole project to do like massive to build like these huge green sponge cities that would absorb water and reduce flood risks. So there's some interesting things I think in the environmental energy space that China can be a model, has been a model in certain areas. They have not been exporting that very well so far. They've been still exporting mostly coal and large infrastructure dams. They haven't been exporting this kind of clean energy, renewable or kind of smart city, like smart green cities yet. But if I think if they do, they could be a win-win. It'd be a way to for developing countries to be able to do more sustainable development, and it would also kind of help China's image quite a bit, because right now they've been seen as someone as a country that's investing mostly in things that are harmful. But if they can invest or promote solutions more, which they are doing domestically but not internationally, I think that's a potential way forward if they want to improve their global image more.
I have two more speculative questions about China and then we'll move on. So first one is so generally there's this argument that as real incomes improve for people living in X country, they generally do like more freedoms, and they would want more rights and freedoms, etc. With that context in mind, do you see some kind of revolution happening in China, where the people might stop taking all the civilians around them, and may start demanding more freedoms and more rights from the CCP? Yeah. Do you see that scenario happening, or is that just fantasy for now?
Yeah, I don't know. So there's always these kind of like moments that take place. I think the most recent one was with the tennis player, Peng. I can't pronounce her name properly, but Peng Shuai, I think, who disappeared after making that small protest, and it was seemed to have been like widely shared in Chinese social media domestically, and there was a clampdown, I think, because they were so concerned that this would turn into something bigger. And then last, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a do one of the doctors in Wuhan who like alerted people that there was this virus and was reprimanded for that before it became a big global story. When he died, there was this huge surge of protests and calls for, freedom of speech. So there are these like small events that seem to take place every once in a while that give like an idea, like maybe at some point the right trigger. Something like what happened in Tunisia with the one man protest burning himself, self-immolation, that sparked this whole Arab Spring of democracy protests. Like, what is that moment going to be like in China? It's really, as someone who doesn't spend that much, hasn't spent that much time domestically in the country, or spent any time in the country really, I can't speculate so much, but I do watch from and it's interesting to see like that there are occasional protests and there are like moments of activism, and I'm curious. At some point, maybe one of those can turn into something bigger. I think it's going to be very unpredictable because you never know, like, what is that spark that would result in something changing. And the second thing is like, Xi Jinping cannot live forever. He's almost 70. There's no succession plan. I wonder what's going to happen when he steps down or he dies, or what's the future of the CCP is not so clear. Like right now, it's very set that he's the leader with the most power since anyone since Mao Zedong. But what's the future after that? Is it sustainable? If the economy continues to falter, it's starting to the growth has been slowing down the last several years. Is that going to create more tension or more pressure for change? So a lot of questions, and I don't have any answers, but there's a lot of things worth a lot of questions and a lot of I think potential there.
Right. You spoke about digital protectionism earlier, and you also referred to that article. So why do you think rest of the countries and even the US has been very patient, and also hasn't done much while their services are not being allowed to operate in China's market? That is part one. And in relation to that, recently I think India had banned a few of those Chinese apps. I think about 60 apps, a major one being TikTok, which is hugely popular in the country. Is that the way to go? To Is that the way to probably contain China's technological rise, or is it like the quid for the quo, but in the sense that they don't allow other countries' apps to operate in their country, so we don't allow Chinese apps to? Is that the way you think the future is going to unfold?
So yeah, in term, I guess when I wrote that article for Engadget, I spoke to some trade experts, and one of the issues that they brought up was that a lot of the global kind of global trade mechanisms like the WTO or free trade agreements like European Free Trade Agreement or NAFTA or bilateral free trade agreements, they didn't really include provisions for digital trade. They were mostly focused on physical goods and services. So that meant that there wasn't really a way for countries to use the WTO or any of these existing agreements to deal with things like China's blocking of Western platforms. And that kind of just meant that when the existing trade offices were just focused on things that they could deal with. And there was a real need, they argued, for global trade mechanisms and global regimes to start figuring out how to deal with the increase in digital trade and digital goods. Which had grown, especially since I think 2010, had become such a big part of the global economy. That wasn't the case when these agreements were determined were agreed to back in the 90s and early 2000s. So I think that's a big limitation, and there are some efforts to incorporate this into newer trade agreements. I think in some of the ones being discussed within Asia, but the problem is that now there's just not much global political will to do free trade agreements globally. You've seen the U.S. drop out, you've seen Brexit in the U.K. So there's a it's really challenging to in this current environment to kind of reform and build a new kind of regime that would deal with things like China's blocking of Western and non-Western apps and platforms. So I in terms of what India did, I think reciprocity is like reciprocal access between two countries. So making sure if one country blocks your apps or platforms like China, I think it's perfectly fine for a country to retaliate and also do the same thing to China, like India did. My only concern is like making sure that's done in a way that doesn't lead to kind of India censoring other things and other platforms. Like making sure that it's done in a way that's legally meant as a meant as reciprocity for something China's done, and not as just another way for censorship, the government to have the power to censor things at their will. One interesting area I did a recent piece on was on diplomatic speech. So China has blocked a lot of Western diplomats and embassies from using Chinese social media to broadcast or share messages within China. While globally, you have Chinese diplomats on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, spreading messages all around the world, oftentimes very pro-China messages. So I think there's a, is it fair to allow Chinese diplomats and Chinese government to use these foreign platforms so freely when they don't allow anyone to use their platforms in China at all? And I think these platforms need to like make clear positions on that because, and or governments need to if the platforms won't. Because it's creating this like real information asynchronicity around the world, where China has access to billions of people through media, through social media, and no one has access to the Chinese audience in the same way. And that's historically, it should be considered a violation of diplomatic norms, I think. But it's such a new area. If you block the that there's not really like norms to deal with how to or norms with how to respond to these kind of actions. So there's a lot of things that need to be determined. There's a, and I hope to see more political will. I hope the Biden administration with the Summit for Democracy will start to deal with some of these issues going forward, hopefully with cooperation from countries like India.
Right. I want to move to tech and talk a little bit about tech. One thing that I found interesting was while reading some of your pieces where you actively call for either deleting a particular app, or you do give out suggestions for alternatives of certain app. In this case, in 2017, I think you wrote about deleting Uber for ethical reasons. It's been I think 4 years, and Travis is also no longer part of the company, at least not in an executive capacity. Do you still feel that way about Uber, or has your view shifted from that initial position?
Yeah, I haven't. I forgot about that piece. So that's a while ago. I still think I still have issues with like the Uber model, Uber, Lyft, and all the on-demand app models, because we've seen since Uber had their IPO, I think 3 years ago, they have been raising rates and cutting kind of the commission that drivers get. And I'm in California. I think a year or two ago. Yeah, I think it was last election. 2020, there was an effort by the state to regulate drivers and saying if they work over a certain number of hours, they have to be classified as employees. And Uber, Lyft, and a couple of other gig companies spent million, I think $50 to $100 million campaigning against those measures and putting a referendum up and winning. So I think the concern is like, it's not so much like the leadership like it was before and some of the issues, but I think the fact that they're trying to use their power to avoid labor laws and to blunt the impact and to also, not they're not paying the drivers enough and they're not held to the same standards as taxi drivers or other smaller taxi companies or smaller independent drivers. I think the issue is not so much any particular company anymore. It's more the how do we regulate the gig industry? It's become it's becoming a bigger part of the economy. There need to be standards for how much workers get paid, minimum wages. There needs to be a system for them to get benefits. There needs to be systems for them to make sure they have grievance mechanisms, because there are concerns that Uber fires drivers that are too active, too activist or organizing, without any recourse. So there needs to be a mechanism to make sure Uber cannot just fire anyone they want without providing reason, because that's workers' livelihoods that are at risk. And if a and if we're dependent so much on these companies for everything, and they can if someone cannot drive for them, how can they make a living? So we need to have like clear, yeah. I think it's right now. It's these companies are here to stay. How do we make sure that they're operating fairly and not harming society is a key concern.
I think you made a similar case, and if I'm not, I mean, is that the same argument that you made for Amazon as well? That you know they're not treating their workers well, especially the warehouse workers, if I'm not wrong. Is that I think you're suggesting people to you know if they like a particular brand to just you know buy that, you know buy the product directly from the brand itself rather than through Amazon. Is that also a similar concern where you know they're not treating workers properly?
Yeah, I think with Amazon, it's Amazon has become such a humongous company. I mean, besides just retail, like they're a tech company, they're dealing the logistics and everything. But yeah, I think they've made a business of like providing something really convenient to consumers, but the way the cost of that convenience is these treating workers not very well and treating their drivers not very well and avoiding at all costs like unionization or even giving full-time employment to a lot of these workers. So yeah, it's a very similar concern, but Amazon is a very different type of company since they're so huge. I think it's a it's I remember when I was like younger, like there was a lot of like efforts against Walmart, because in the I think globally Walmart was kind of the biggest retailer before Amazon, and in many ways like Amazon is a lot worse. But they're not as visible because you don't see it when you don't go to a Walmart. And when you go to a Walmart, you would see the workers and you see kind of the conditions. But you don't see the conditions of Amazon workers because they're in these warehouses that are far away and hidden. And you don't the only interaction you have is with the driver, and that's very rare. You don't see the drivers come knock on your door. They just leave the package at your door. So I guess a lot of the I think one of the interesting things about Amazon is that it's invisible. Kind of the things that are happening, people can easily avoid it or not notice it because it's so far away. And that I think makes it makes it more difficult to raise awareness about what's happening and also to research and report on it. But yeah, it's a lot of the same issues, and it's I guess just a question of like what kind of society we want to live in. If we're going to purchase everything from Amazon all the time, and we're going to allow these kind of worker these kind of these abuses to continue, then like we're going to live in a world without with less small retailers, less community, less grocery stores in our neighborhood, less kind of that traditional retail business environment that kind of built communities. And is that the future we want? Do we want everything just to be coming from someplace far away in an impersonal mechanism, impersonal way? So yeah, Amazon is a it's an interesting case. And yeah, it's a very it's a complicated situation to determine how to regulate a company that's so big and has created this like global model based on this kind of exploitation of low wage workers.
Do you think there's a lot of talk about you know breaking up big tech? Do you support you know breaking up of Amazon slash Google slash Facebook?
Yeah, I it's not like I guess the question more should be like for me, like when I first started like my process to quit Google, the question was more like, is it possible to quit Google? Is it possible to like get the same services through a different platform? And is it easy? So I think the argument for breaking up the companies is it's more about like, do users have a choice? Do we have like a choice? Do we have like an alternative, a valuable alternative to these big tech companies? And if we don't, why don't we have a viable alternative? And how does regulation create alternatives that can create provide competition? And if breaking up is one of the ways to do that, maybe it is, but maybe breaking up these companies won't address that core problem. I think actually what would be more interesting is kind of things like interoperability. So if I join like an alternative to Facebook, but I could still like message people on Facebook because Facebook is regulated to be operable with other platforms. That might actually be a better model than breaking up Facebook. You would actually provide people with choices, but still not force them to like leave, force them to be isolated if you quit Facebook. And same thing with Google. If you could, if like, other companies had access to Google, I guess the, when it comes to Google, like the key issue, one of the key issues I think I would support breaking up is the connection between advertising and search, because Google has an incentive, since their revenue comes from advertising and they control search, and they're both kind of intertwined, there's a lot of concerns that they might be manipulating search results to promote their advertising or vice versa. And maybe it's not good to have the same company control both. And in that case, maybe it makes sense to make sure advertising and search are separate, so that there's not those kind of incentives to the incentives that they use to manipulate certain things. Maybe the case, but I think
I
it's,
mean,
sorry.
on the Google ad scenario, I mean, generally when Google does place advertisements for a search query, they generally do give they generally do have a disclaimer, right? That that it's an ad per se. They do, yeah. So I mean, they are being transparent. I mean, it's I don't think they're being I don't think they're deceiving people into. Do you think that's the case? They're actively deceiving people into thinking that it's not an ad?
Well, there's been some, it's not necessarily that. Like, I think they have not been deceiving people like that, but there are some instances where it's unclear if like companies that don't promote themselves on ads like drop in the search rankings, for example. So you and then there's also instances where if you don't promote yourself with ads, your company or brand may not show up on the first page. So like the incentives are kind of there for Google to do things like that. It's unclear if they're doing it. But it's also like it's also like if the same company controls both, and now Google kind of in America, Google and Facebook I think control something like 80% or 90% of online advertising now. So you have like a more clear case that there is like a monopoly or duopoly in the advertising space. So maybe and you're seeing, I mean, you've seen all the impacts of that for the newspaper industry in the Western world, where newspapers no longer have access to ads or they're relying on Google. Guardian did an interesting story recently, or no, a couple of years ago, where they tried to pay for ads on Guardian and tried to see how much money actually went to Guardian if they were using Google. And it was something like less than 30 cents out of a dollar actually went to Guardian. So the 70% was going to Google. And that's a huge amount. And there's, if you don't have an alternative, then Google can keep raising that rate as much as it wants. And then the newspapers or other companies, if they're relying on Google for all their ad traffic or any traffic, search and ad traffic, yeah, you can see there's just it gets murky. There's a lot of potential ethical issues. So and right now, I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to know because we don't have access to Google's algorithm, like how they're manipulating things. So maybe they're not doing it, maybe they are, but it's unclear. But there is a potential.
Right. You wrote an article called "There is literally no excuse to keep using Facebook," I think in 2018. Can you tell us like why you think that people should not be using Facebook?
Yeah, I guess my case for the article was just like at that time, I really just felt like Facebook was allowing itself to be a platform that was manipulated by bad actors. I mean, it and this meant like, this was right around the time when we had the first wave of Rohingya refugees in Myanmar, and it was a really clear argument that Facebook was used to kind of ramp up anti-Muslim sentiment in Myanmar, and that led to this genocide, and that the company didn't regulate content very properly or very well, and they kind of just allowed this to happen. And I think there was just like several instances where Facebook had been too late or too slow or allowed bad actors to utilize a platform in a way. And I feel like they had, by 2018, they had so many chances to fix their problems, but they had kind of clearly shown that they care more about ad revenue than they did about user safety. There was, smaller things. Like I noticed like a lot more people were getting arrested for posting content on Facebook globally. It didn't seem like Facebook really prioritized users' privacy or user security, or they were even going to provide that option to users. I also had issues. I have always had issues with the fact that Facebook is really controlled by one person. You have the CEO, the chairman of the board, and the majority stockholder is just one person, Mark Zuckerberg. Most companies have at least some division of accountability or some mechanism within the company for other people to oppose the CEO or oppose the director of the board. When you have this one person in charge, you kind of just have to hope that one person cares or does the right thing. And there hasn't been any evidence that he has taken these concerns with how Facebook is being used globally seriously. And if he's not going to, and there's no way to force him to, and there's all these kind of bad things happening, there were genocide or disinformation. Now you're seeing Facebook as a platform for anti-vaxxers and COVID disinformation. Is it really worth using this platform? I guess that's just, I just wanted to pose the question. Like I made a decision it wasn't, and I wanted people to kind of consider, I wanted people to really think, like, if you're using this platform, you're kind of an enabler of the things that the platform allows. You cannot just be a neutral user. You're actively allowing these things to happen because you're the revenue source for Facebook, because your profile provides a space for them to sell ads to all types of people. And if you are on the platform, you're allowing them to sell these ads. There's just no way around that.
Right. I think one of the things that stop me if I'm wrong. I think one of the case that you made was that one thing that you did not like that Facebook was doing. It was allowing hate speech and Holocaust deniers, etc. Are you in support of Facebook? I mean, are you saying that Facebook should not do content mod Facebook should be doing content moderation?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question because it's, but I think Facebook should be doing a lot more content moderation than it is. And I think I think especially they need to be doing a much better job of content moderation in developing countries and in other language markets, because I think they're really neglecting that, which I see especially in Southeast Asia. But it is a difficult question. I'm not sure like the right amount, like what's the right amount of content moderation or how it should be done. I think there should be like a deeper discussion about, and I think it's because there has been a big discussion over the last couple of years of like what are the limits of content moderation? How do you do it properly, and how do you make sure it's, what's the line between content moderation and censorship, and who makes the decisions? And those are all difficult questions. I think, I'd like to see Facebook at least like engaging outsiders a lot more, or trying to like have these discussions with journalists or with fact checkers. One of the disappointing things, I think, after the 2016 election in the US, when they made this kind of commitment, we're going to work with journalists and fact checkers, is that a lot of those fact-checking organizations and journalists that did end up working with Facebook, they never really felt like Facebook was taking their concerns or their input seriously. They felt like it was just for show. And I've seen this in the Philippines. Rappler and Maria Ressa, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, she's brought up a lot of the same concerns. Like Facebook reached out to us, but they never took any of the things we mentioned seriously, and they didn't seem like they really cared about our concerns and how we and the content we were seeing. It's a similar story in Myanmar. So there's a lot. I think there's a lot more Facebook can do. And I would like to see like a broader discussion, maybe not just about Facebook, but in general, like how do we regulate content, in how do we manage content in a world where it's just so much of it. And it's there. How do we make sure that platforms are regulated and safe spaces, but we don't get into, how do we make sure there's a division between that and like censorship of valid opinions and perspectives?
Right. I think you spent a, I think you said you spent a year without Google. What made you do that, and how was the experience of not using the world's most used search engine?
Yeah, I've mostly not been using Google for a couple of years now. But it was initially just like an experiment. Like I wanted to see if it was possible to quit Google. I wanted to just like, yeah, because I remember like the earlier days of the internet, since like in the early 2000s, when people would switch platforms regularly. and you just had a new email address. I remember starting with Hotmail and then going to like mail.com and then using different search engines. I like vaguely remember those like memories of just like trying different search engines and but now I realize like everything I was doing was just in Google. So how did I wanted to just like see if it was possible. It was just like a thought experiment that kind of turned into an article when another journalist suggested I write it. That kind of turned into something bigger when the article became really popular, beyond my expectations, because I think a lot of people had the same question. And the kind of the answer was just like I wanted, why is it so difficult to quit Google? And
I'm so
like,
sorry.
yeah.
Before, so you said, why is it so difficult to quit Google? I mean, another question that could be asked is, I mean, is there a need? Is there a need to quit Google in the first place? I mean.
Yeah, I guess it's a that was the thing. It was just like for me, it was just an idea like it should be possible because you should have the choice as a consumer to use whatever platform you want, and you should have alternatives. You shouldn't be dependent on one company. So it's more just like a like that's how I want to see the internet. It's more so it's more just my personal perspective. Like I want to see an internet where there's multiple options and there's diversity and there's, you know, not just a few companies controlling the global web. I'd like to see, you know, there's yeah, like there should be like opportunities for Indian entrepreneurs and Indonesian entrepreneurs to like create platforms that people can use, and it shouldn't just be like the fact that we are all dependent on just one or two companies. So it was about what kind of web do we want? Should it be a diverse, multicultural, multilingual like web, or should it be one where kind of we're dependent on one company, one or two companies, or a few companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, that are kind of the back end for everything. I guess if people are happy with Google, they can keep using it. And I think there is an argument that like they provide a lot of good services for free, and the paying for your privacy, if someone is willing to give up your privacy for these free services, that should be a decision they can make individually. But if they have no choice and their only choice is to use Google and give up your privacy, that's a little bit problematic. So for me, I just wanted to see if it was possible, and then wanted to share that experience to show that it's really difficult. At that time, it was really difficult, and these are and why it's so difficult, and kind of like bring up some discussion about like should the web be like this? Should the internet be like this? And that was really it. There was not a big agenda or plan. It was just a thought experiment that kind of turned into something bigger.
I think finally, so I mean, what I mean, what if it's in the nature of, you know, technology companies that it generally produces a winner take all effect, and let's say, you know, somebody in Ecuador, you know, releases a search engine, and you know that becomes globally popular, and now that's the most, you know, dominant search engine in the world. Would in that case, the case being like, you know, any kind of technology is like winner take all, and you know it will have a dominant share in the market. Would you still, you know, force regulators to probably induce more competition, or you know maybe contain that dominant search engine, search company, whatever it may be? Am I clear?
Yeah,
I don't
that's a
know.
good question. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm curious about that. I wonder first of all if it's possible for someone in Ecuador to do that, because right now, like the only companies that have been able to create global platforms have been American companies, all basically from the same region. So I wonder if like the only country that has really been able to create alternatives is China, and they did this through like you know blocking Western platforms from entering the country. And you have a few exceptions in a few places, like Korea has Naver, and you have I think some social networks in Russia. But otherwise, it's most of the platforms and apps are coming from you know just a few places. So I'm curious if that's possible, if it's possible for someone in Ecuador or someone in the global South, especially a smaller global South country, to make a platform that becomes a global platform. Because I don't really think it's possible at this point, because I think the money and capital are coming from just a few places, like Silicon Valley, and there's some emerging alternatives in places like India and China and maybe Southeast Asia a little bit, but it's still, you know, the capital and finance is still coming just from, even in those areas, a lot of the capital is coming from the US, and a lot of the ownership or is the American capital, or even Google and face Google has a lot of investments in those regions as well. Yeah, and I guess in terms of regulators, like I guess if it's, it gets back to what I said before, like it's maybe it's fine for Google to control search, but is it fine for Google to control search and advertising and like, you know, and messaging and all these other things? Like I guess how many kind of platforms or how many kind of services should one company be dominant in? And I think that's the question for regulators more than just if was it okay for one company to dominate search? Should one company dominate search and all these other products as well, like Google does? And is there any problem with the fact that they control those corresponding markets? And are they kind of using that as that power in ways that harm the ability of things like newspapers or smaller publications or other kind of companies to compete or to survive? Those are the more of the key questions for regulators rather than is it okay for Google to control search by itself? Because I don't know if you can prevent Google from controlling search until there's an alternative that's good. And right now, even though I use DuckDuckGo most of the time, it's not as good as Google, even now. And the alternatives are not as good out there. So there is a reason, there is a good reason Google still dominates search.
I thought you'd be using Bing. Okay, all right.
I sometimes use Bing. I guess DuckDuckGo is actually mostly Bing searches. So
Oh, okay.
it's
Okay,
that
I
it's
didn't
actually
know that.
yeah. So it's yeah, it's so I think they get their searches from some other sources, but I think primarily it's Bing.
Oh, okay. On that note, Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time. It was wonderful having you.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.